this whole course is focused obviously heavily on morphogenesis, on movements, on changes in cell shape. A lot of processes that you can intuitively, I think all of us, whether we're biologists or physicists in our training, think of in a certain kind of mechanical perspective. Because as humans living on this earth, we have an understanding of mechanics, and one of the natural things to do is to look at patterns of embryonic movement and translate them into mechanics. Now, one of the really central things that we all intuitively understand is that mechanics imply some kind of localization of forces, and therefore some kind of spatial pattern. So what I decided to do today was to focus this morning's lecture really on work that's actually more specifically directed towards establishing spatial pattern, rather than establishing or thinking about the real the mechanics. And the idea, and I'll try to come back to this at the end, and I'm going to try to do something really controversial, well, not controversial, but really challenging, is to open the discussion up, I'll open the lecture up into a, even more of a discussion than what we've had so far. But what the specific kind of the questions that I would like to address in the opening part have to do with the idea of positional information, and specifically the grain of that information. What we'd like to know when we look at embryos, we look at patterns, is the underlying positional information something that is broadly spread out? Is it graded? Is it discrete? Is it discrete in blocks of cells? If it's discrete in blocks of cells, how small are those blocks? What's the grain of the information, of the spatial distinctions that are made in terms of gene activity? And then, and I'm going to argue that that grain is extremely fine. And then what we're really going to focus on is how do cells achieve a reproducibly fine grain of positional information on which you can build the local cellular properties, generate local forces, locally change the physical properties of cells to account for the morphogenesis. So that's the idea of what I want to do today. I've given parts of this lecture different times over the past year and a half. I've never given this lecture strung with all the different parts strung together in the particular pattern that I'm trying to do today. So it would be really wonderful if, as I go through this talk, you'll, as is traditional in these lectures, interrupt as often as possible. And we'll see how far we can proceed. So my basic plan is that I'm going to talk initially about a set of experiments, or a long-term set of experiments that a group of us at Princeton, Thomas Greger, Bill Bial, and Mariella Petkova, have been carried out in the past year or so directly to address this problem of the positional information that's supplied in maternal gradients, its reproducibility, and the extent that the information that's inherent integrated in a gradient can be transferred into discrete patterns of zygotic gene activity. I'm going to do that also, you'll see, in the context of a Bayesian information theory. So what we're going to really try to do is to extract lookup tables, lookup tables that one could imagine cells are using to determine their position and determine their genetics. That's going to be the first part. And then, because this then puts a very heavy emphasis on the ability, as we'll see, of maternal gradients of transcription factors, one particular transcription factor, a big thing, of establishing really, really precise patterns of gene expression, zygotic transcription in the embryo, I'm going to spend a good fraction of this lecture talking about what we understand about transcription. Specifically, in the fly embryo, I'm going to present some recent work by Shelby Blythe and Colleen Hannon that really will actually probably serve for many of you as a broad review of everything from chromatin structure to enhancers to concentration-dependent responses of individual stretches of DNA to different concentrations. Because ultimately, we're going to see that's going to be what's going to drive the pattern in the embryo. And then, depending on how long it takes me to do these two topics, what I'd like to do is return back from the knowledge that we gain from those transcription studies and try to translate it back into the embryo. And we're going to look at some more movies of embryos, and we're going to talk about two phenomena that we casually worked on, but that I believe we mechanically don't really understand at all, as the way different folds in epithelia occur, and then ask, and then try to begin to think mechanically, but mechanically in the context of specific properties of cells that you might have in one area of the embryo or another that might be traceable back to transcriptional responses and therefore to maternal gradients. So that's the plan. Okay. So a lot of work over the past 30 years has given us really a strong insight into where pattern comes from in the Drosophila embryo. We know that at the time when the egg is laid, the egg is, although 99.9% of all the gene products that are in the egg are probably uniformly distributed throughout the whole egg cytoplasm. There are a small number of RNAs that are localized to specific regions. One of the best studied of these is an RNA called Bicoid. It plays a critical role in controlling the anterior posterior pattern in the embryo. Because deposited in the developing oocyte by the mother is a cluster of RNA at the anterior end of the egg. It's not translated until fertilization. When the egg is fertilized or activated, this untranslated RNA is translated into a protein that controls a transcription factor. That transcription factor will bind to DNA and generally is viewed as activating transcription. Because the source of this protein is this cluster of RNA at the anterior end of the egg. The RNA is anchored or localized in a complex way, but the protein is believed to be freely diffusible from this source of synthesis. And its continued synthesis and degradation coupled with diffusion yields a gradient, a concentration gradient, along the anterior-posterior axis. Such that the individual nuclei, you can think of, have their positions defined in the embryo by the local immediate concentration of Bicoid protein. This transcriptional activator activates a set of downstream genes that are called gap genes, and they are expressed in particular patterns. One of the ideas we're going to deal with here is that these expression patterns are direct readouts of the concentration of Bicoid in individual regions of the embryo, and almost immediately, that is to say within 20 to 30 minutes after the establishment of this pattern, these gap genes go on to establish complex patterns of expression that are actually now along the anterior-posterior axis of the embryo, define in local areas defined patterns that are specific, as we'll see, down to single cells. So the question is, how does this system work? Where is the information content? And here, I think this movie will actually be able to...
Sorry, Eric. Yes. Can you tell us, what's the length?
The length scale here is 500 microns, 150 microns here. What we're watching in this movie here is the synthesis and establishment of this Bitcoin gradient during these cleavage divisions that you can that occur early in the embryo. So this is a GFP-tagged version of the protein, which is fully functional and can substitute quantitatively for the wild-type pattern. The nuclei initially in the surface, but when the nuclei move out, interiorly, when they move out to the surface, you can see this, it's already at cycle 10. This protein is graded. Thomas Greger, in his in 2007 paper, showed that from the earliest stages where we can measure the protein concentrations at the surface, the protein concentrations at a given point along the x-axis are constant and established. So this gradient is established rather rapidly and then is stably maintained in the nuclei in a given position. You define that position. The other thing that was very striking in Thomas's work was that while initially various characterizations of the Bitcoin gradient, including some that we had done ourselves, had suggested that the gradient or the protein distribution was somewhat variable from one embryo to the other, or from one stage to the other, what was remarkable was that when Thomas measured this in living embryos, avoiding them our problems of fixation artifacts, antibody statings, and simply measured absolute quantities of GFP, the variability on a cell-by-cell basis was about 10%, which was close to the change in concentration between one neighbor and the next. So what this meant was that if you, for a cell sitting at some position along the length of the embryo, its estimation of where it was about, we could show, was about had a 1%, it's 1% of the error, 1%, could estimate its position to within 1% accuracy, which, since there are about 100 cells along the anterior posterior axis of the embryo, meant that this, the information content was implicit in this gradient, was sufficient to already distinguish single cells from their immediate neighbors.
Except over there. Hmm? In that central region.
Yes, in the central region. And so there's information, if you look at the, there's information in the central region. The analysis was tricky to carry out at the poles where the concentrations were very low and our measurements were increasingly unreliable. They also, as you see, and so they begin to go up, and he even stopped someplace out here, just because the accurate, or his ability to measure the information goes down here. But it's also abnormal, it seems to shift and be less accurate at the anterior end of the embryo. And we argued back and forth a lot about what this meant. Thomas's belief, in part, was that this was still artifacts of how one measures things on curved surfaces. I don't think that's the real explanation. I think that subsequent data suggests an alternative model. Basically, the reproducibility is, in a certain sense, remarkable, but in a way it may not be so remarkable. If you put a constant supply source of RNA at the anterior end of the embryo, you allow that to be made at some constant source, diffuse, it's going to be reproduced. We know from Thomas's later measurements that the amount of RNA is extraordinarily tightly controlled, so the source of this is very... What is more variable, and Sean Little in in my lab in collaboration with Thomas, they showed that what's more variable is the actual distribution of the RNA, in that it's anchored initially and then moves and becomes more diffuse. So if you think about the way a gradient is going to of this kind is going to form, the peak values are going to depend on the local concentration. The more tightly, if you take the same amount of RNA and concentrate it really, really tightly, you will get a higher local concentration. The more diffuse the RNA, the more the lower the concentration is going to be in this source region. But once you get outside the source region, the shape of the gradient really depends now just on the movement of the protein relative to its lifetime. That is the diffusion constant relative to the lifetime of the protein. So outside this source, the gradient is going to be it's going to be very reproducible. What that might tell us then, in thinking about gradients, is that gradients are useful sources of positional information the farther, potentially the farther and farther you are away from the source. At the source, you probably, particularly in cases like this when you're diffuse, you might need more additional sources of information. As we'll see in this talk, later in the talk, there are the patterning in this area here of the embryo is in part governed by bickering, but is also governed by other positional inputs into the embryo. Whereas patterning in the middle of the embryo seems more exclusively to be in the middle. Okay?
Can I ask for a clarification? So in the first in the image before, you show a gradient which was also spread in the volume of the embryo, while here it seems only at the surface of the embryo.
Yeah, that's because the way we are Thomas says we're focusing here on an optical cross-section. This is the area where we are focusing through the minimum amount of cytoplasm. So we know if we fix embryos and look at the where we and then use optical clearing strategies that allow us to see nuclei in the middle, we see wherever there are nuclei in the middle of the embryo, we see comparable concentrations to that at the surface. So the gradient is moving through the whole volume of the egg. We also know that in terms of transcriptional responses, interestingly, the nuclei in the interior of the embryo are responding transcriptionally, in terms of, say, expressing hunchback, at the same boundaries as those on the surface. More questions? Yeah?
Can I then ask, in addition to that, whether the quantification that you have there of the intensity, is that from the surface or from the whole thing?
From the surface. From the surface, yeah, from an optical cross-section. Okay, so...
Can I ask a question? So when you say that a cell can determine its position to 1%, what you mean is that we can determine its position to 1% from our embedding?
Absolutely. So yeah. We're good.
The sound might be better than, right?
Just the sound could be, yeah.
Could we say, okay, you know, there's too much noise here, we can't determine it. And I've seen a lot of papers that make those kinds. I mean, here you're making a positive claim.
No,
that the cell can't. But when people say it can't, I feel squeamish because I'm saying, no, you can't tell. But the cell maybe is better than you and better than your measurement.
Oh, I believe cells are better than me in almost every respect. Right. So, and that will actually be the point. Because the information is there, or at least this much information is there. We're limited in our ability to measure that information. The question is, cells, can they register that information? We say, how does the cell use that information? What it really means is, can we take the information content of this gradient and translate it into immediately into transcriptional responses on a cell-by-cell basis that preserve the information that's there.
So is there any evidence that cells like integrating over time and then maybe we could do better than 1%?
It could be. It could certainly be better. And cells might be doing that. There could be more information. If we would integrate over time, we might get more information. And if cells integrated over time, they, you know, we could be more accurate. So this, so that the, so exactly the question where we wanted to go is here. The information is there, so how do cells use it? Yes?
What would happen if you shift the whole curve up or down? You keep the gradients as is, but you shift the absolute value.
Yeah, so you would, one of the ways of doing that is to add additional copies of the gene. So you add more RNA, or reduce the RNA by half. And when you do that, you get essentially the same gradient with the same lambda of distribution, but you have a lower peak, and so your values are correspondingly lowered or increased. The responses become somewhat more complicated in those circumstances, but if you measure the gradient, it behaves just like you would think a source with constant degradation, constant diffusion, and the shape or the height of the gradient depends on the intensity of the source. No feedback regulation.
My question was regarding the cell fate. So do you see that the cells are sensitive also to the absolute value or only to the gradient?
They are sensitive to the absolute value. We'll come to that. Well, maybe we should come to that at the end. I'll present everything we know, and then we can decide whether we're convinced or not. Okay? Right. So, what we really want to know is how accurate, the way of saying is how accurately can cells read gradients as position information lost in the transition between maternal gradients and the first level of zygotic gene expression, that is, gap genes. So the approach that we've taken to that is focused on the middle region of the embryo, middle 80% of the embryo, if you will, where the pattern is controlled by four gap genes, Kuppel, Knips, Kuppel, Giant, and Hunchback, that are expressed in somewhat overlapping domains, usually one or two broad regions of the embryo, develop antibodies to each of these in different animals such that we're able to simultaneously measure the levels of all of these gene products in the same embryo, and then quantitative, this is originally Julian DeBruce's. And the conclusion from those studies was that if you used just the, and these are done without normalization, meaning essentially set up with a internal, wild type, can we, in a given experiment where you have 100 and something embryos, can we determine to what extent is the information here sufficient to determine position? And what we concluded in those studies was that the information is there in the immediate responses at 15 minutes into cycle 14. For the information to be there, though, you have to change a little bit how you would traditionally think about these genes were initially presented as kind of on-off block, genes that define regions or blocks in the embryo. And the only way that you could get that the information is preserved, but it is in fact preserved more in the regions where the gene activities are declining. That's where your real positional information is. And what Julian's thesis showed was actually that these regions of decline are sufficiently reproducible that individual cells along the axis can define their positions. Yes?
Presumably, the protein's concentration is rising and falling as the embryo is developing. But right now, we are just looking at a snapshot.
We're looking at a snapshot, a time point where we believe the time point was close to the maximum expression pattern of these genes in early cycle 14. It's also the time point from Julian studies where the information content is greatest. So the way he did these was to collect very large numbers of embryos, stage them in 5-minute intervals during the 55 minutes of cycle 14, and then cluster it. For a particular stage, you could do this analysis and ask, what's the stage of maximum expression, which is about 15 minutes in, and that turns out to be the period of maximum information content. So, what I'd like to do though now is, building on Julian's stuff, in our sense that patterns were very accurate, what Mariella Petkova has done, this is again a collaboration with Gaspar Tajik Thomas and Bill, was to ask, can we describe this information content in a way that is a language? Can we get in some way close to something that's almost like a lookup table? We can imagine what the cell is doing, measuring these concentrations, and then predicting downstream fate. So, can we begin to build a device, an intellectual a device for measuring expression patterns and treating them? And we've used basically we're using this same strategy, but now we're going to try to translate.
Can I ask a question about the last thing that you said? Sorry, it's not on the slide, but the gap genes were identified because when you mutate them, you lose whole sections of the pattern. I totally see why the information content is greater in the regions where their expression is graded than in the regions where it's uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, at the end of the day, the phenotype is that you're missing the region. You're
missing a chunk. So what that tells you is that you need the gene activity in the high levels as well as in the low, in the graded levels. When we come back to think about what a combinatorial code would be that's going to define these positions, what it means is that one has meaning. The spatial information within that area where, say, hunchback has a value of 1 is being provided by, to a certain extent, is being provided by other genes. But the
but at some level the gap could just be cell death, right? So are the cells just, is one just
living? What we do know from these is that the gap is initially a change in gene expression pattern, and a change therefore in the way the combinatorial code is read out at the next level.
Can I ask?
Yes.
Is there any growth at the same time that it is?
There's no growth. The time period that we're dealing with is about 45 minutes. We'll talk a little bit later about time when we get into the mechanics of the molecular biology of transcription. But you establish some of these genes come on in a transient and lower level in early cycles, but the peak level is at about 15 minutes into cycle 14. And then the levels begin to decline, and the embryo gets into the next stage, which is a parallel gene. So we think these are direct. There's no growth, no mitosis, the same nuclei distributed over the whole surface of the embryo. So the way this is this ideal circumstance that we can try to follow the trend, the position. So just to kind of try it, what we do in the lab is we can measure, for example, concentration at different points along the anterior posterior, the axis of the embryo. So that means that those expression patterns, we can express the probability distribution or probability of a particular concentration of cripple given its a position along the x-axis. So we can, this is the, it would be an experimental piece of data, right? Yes?
Just a small practical question. You're presenting everything as
scale to the length of the embryo. Is there anything going on in the other directions?
Yes. Generally, the embryo is, if we were to focus out, it would be pretty much the same position all around. There's a subtle difference in terms of the shape of the dorsal versus the ventral side of the embryo. There's also a patterning system that's operating on the ventral side that's establishing basically it's like a Cartesian coordinate system where you have a pattern this way and a pattern that way. And to the large extent, the first approximation, pattern this way is independent of the pattern this way. Although ultimately some of the downstream response genes are going to integrate both that in.
But at this stage, everything's pretty much this.
Yeah, so we're only going to talk about this, and that seems to be a good approximation. Susan?
How do you know if these eggs actually develop? But if you take those eggs where the mutations don't occur properly, so they're fat,
yes.
Do they develop so far as that you can measure a big point gradient? So if you just basically
yes,
change
good.
The shape of that
right.
thing?
In the lab. In this course, we have short little round eggs that we are going to try to measure gradients. Overall, the curious thing is that things seem to scale with length.
And not with
physical, not with physical distance. And so we don't quite understand. So percent egg length gives us our lowest, even when we look purely at big weight. Gives us our, and we have done things where we even clone big ways out of houseflies that are big eggs that are 4 or 5 times as big. I looked at the shapes of the gradients, and they are physically bigger because they expand the whole length. But if we take those clone genes and put them into melanogaster, they make the melanogaster scaled gradients. So there is something about the egg that allows this system to produce scalable.
Even when it has to move through a larger volume for the same.
Yeah, so I don't understand that. Okay. And we are somewhat limited in our range, so we can change it by 20% to 30%, like make eggs that are fat and round or long, and they seem to scale. Don't understand. Yes?
Is the quantification of grupal intensity on the dorsal side or the ventral side, or is it averaged?
It is on the dorsal side, I think. Okay. We picked one.
Okay, yeah.
And that was also, it's entirely trivial when you mount eggs to mount them always on the side. And so Mariella was spectacular at this. And so we're able to get it. But when you look at the embryo, I'm sorry, the point was this is what you measure. And this, though, what you'd really like to know is you'd like to know X. Given a particular, what the cell wants to know is X given a particular concentration. And you could, what's that? Yeah. So one of the ways of doing that in just Bayesian logic is to take this value, the probability of X, which we assume to be on a cell by cell basis uniform along the length of the embryo, and overall concentration of cripple, and we can essentially flip this, look up this distribution based. This is a weird graphic, but you get the idea that now, given a particular concentration of cripple, conceptually, you can ask, the embryo can ask, where is it in the egg? Obviously, you have low levels, you're not quite sure where you are, and high levels, or intermediate levels, or high levels, give you a certain amount of positional information. So low levels here, you know you're someplace around here and here in the egg, given cripple concentrations at this level. And in this region, you are, you know you're somewhere around here, and this gives you the information that you need. The information is somewhat ambiguous, both with respect, because see. So we can. Now, what we're going to do, though, is try to take that and make a different kind of map, which is a map where your actual position versus your estimated position. So as we move through this curve here, we can plot out. This is kind of like our where we are versus where we think, where the cell we're thinking is. And you can judge now from the thickness of these lines, if you will, and the fuzziness, how much information is there. So this is now a pattern that we're going to start using. And the advantage of this pattern, you'll see, is that it allows us to begin superimposing more and more information. So information from other gap genes, and that's easier to do than in a pattern like this. So this is our positional accuracy of the information that we have here. You can actually see, this is an interesting illustration, that if you're here, you know very precisely where you are, because the thickness of the line is very small, but you could be in one of two places. Here, you're less good at the peak, but you're only in one place. Here you're right, yes.
I wondered how the cell really measures for itself the total concentration or the concentration of cripple. So does it more sense like in the neighboring regions there's a bit less and there's a bit more cripple, or does it really? I mean, this looks more like in total.
Absolutely. And so we'll come to that molecularly. Our attempts to understand. And then I'll tell you that our belief is right now that it is entirely local, does not involve comparing responses immediately next to, it is an individual cell measuring a concentration, a number of molecules.
Okay.
Crystal.
How do I have to think of the yellow blotches there in the bottom left thing at negative cripple concentrations?
Which is the yellow, that?
Yeah.
What is that? I actually don't know, because this is zero.
That's my problem.
Yeah, it's not even, I have no idea.
Okay.
Look at this, yes. Okay, another question, yeah.
Here again, what you plot, you refer to absolute values of your, RNA, right?
Or absolute intensities of the antibody staining that we're using. So we assume that absolutely the intensity of the signal is proportional to the concentration of the protein.
And did you try to do the same with gradients? Just to see whether one gives you better information compared to the other.
Say that again.
Instead of looking at the values of the concentration, look at the local gradient.
No, we haven't. At least.
Because in the beginning of the talk, you used gradients throughout the time.
But a gradient what was done was there a local concentration, the concentration of bicoid at a given position had a variability, or I can't remember what whether it was the standard, whatever it was, that was 10%, and the next cell was different by 10%, so you had an accurate, but it was always a local measurement of concentration of bicoid rather than a slope. Yes?
At the beginning of the talk, that bicoid looks variable when you use antibodies and better when you use GFP.
Well, it looked variable partially when we used antibodies. Depending on how we were doing the antibodies, we were also doing something, we were normalizing rather than using absolute concentrations, and we were normalizing to the peak values, which is the most variable region that we have. And so what that does, if you anchor at your peak value, which is variable, then everything else in your gradient becomes artificially variable, because you're anchoring it at the wrong point. And that was one of the errors that we made in our original.
So this data doesn't suffer from those.
Yes?
sorry, I'm going a bit ahead, but if I were to overlay the if boundary, for instance, if 2 or if 5 here, where would it be?
Say if?
The if stripe boundary, say if 2 and if 5, where would they be on this picture, roughly?
Oh gosh. if 2, I think, would be about here. And Eve 6 is here. We'll come actually to Eve in a little bit, okay? We'll translate
okay,
this
okay,
into
okay,
yeah.
Okay, fine.
Oh, so we're just doing that again. I'm sorry. so then you had this figure here. Obviously, this isn't enough to unambiguously define position all along the anterior portion. So we can now, though, begin to add additional gap gene expression patterns. And so here, we add additional our knowledge about the hunchback pattern. We lose this cross pattern because we lose the ambiguities here. We maintain the accuracy of the preciseness of the position, but since hunchback is expressed on this side and not on this side, we gain we don't gain precision, but we lose ambiguity. We begin to get, we still have additional ambiguities out of this fuzzy region where cripple wasn't very helpful for us, in that we have basically get ambiguous cross-like patterns wherever you have a peak where you have two going up and down. So we have So when we add the two remaining gap genes, what we get is a pattern like this. So unambiguously in the information expressed in the gap genes are the information about position, and we can a cell sitting at this actual position here can, with a degree of accuracy, determine knows as its estimated position corresponds. Yes.
How many cells can you put into the fuzziness? What's the fuzziness?
About one cell. It depends. You know, it's 1 to 2 cells. That's good. Now, so this is a lookup table, if you will. So what we can ask is, it's a lookup table that's derived for the process in wild-type embryos. Can we ask, can we, to test whether this lookup table really works or is useful, is what the cells are using, what we can do, and the plan here is, so this is even some individual positions here on this correspond to the Eve stripes that you're asking about. And they will provide markers, the other pair we'll use will provide markers for the next set of experiments, which is where we can ask, is this really what's going on? Well, that's one of the ways of...
Why would you use the gap genes to determine the position along the axis?
There's two questions. Why would I use it? And then why would an embryo use it? All right, so we know that the most immediate response to Bicoid transcription factor is the pattern of gap genes. And so we're interested in the, in part, the way I phrased the question was the transfer of information from a maternal gradient into a zygotic response. So that was in part our choice because we wanted to get as close as possible to a single step in information transfer rather than, you know, the game that we all played as children where we kind of whisper in somebody's ear and you whisper in somebody's ear and you whisper the next kid and the thing changed. Obviously, with each step of information transfer, you have the opportunity to lose information. So since we were really interested in what's the maximum transfer of information, that's why we chose gap genes. Why the embryo in evolution chose, there could be scale issues here, or maybe you might say, well, why, another way of asking, why are there only 4 why didn't you have a response set that was 1,000 or 100 different genes, each of which was coming on at one, you know, so I don't know those answers.
The answer why there's four is it works with four. Hmm? The answer as to why there's four is that it works with four. You need four, four to make it work.
Yeah, you, could, you don't need, didn't need more. You could have done it, though, with two if you had broader distributions. But the animal does it with four. Yes, here.
But is there a temporary delay in coming up of these transcription factors to all four gap genes come?
No.
Are they transcribed?
And I could show you a movie that I deleted where, since we have the time points for everything, from this, we can start at a zero or a zero time entering in the cycle and see how they all change. And that, I believe, that is ultimately informative, particularly in the context of the next experiments I'm going to talk about.
How do we know there are only four gap genes?
Okay. gap genes were identified in the mutagenesis experiment that we talked about a week ago. And there were only four genes which showed, which were essential for large non-repeated patterns in the embryo. And they were, we called those genes the four gap genes. There is one more, the potentially tailless, which is out at the dominant pattern out at the poles, that we also identified, but we didn't call it. We didn't let it join the club of the gap gene club. How do we know that there are only four depends on the argument that I gave you, the flawed argument that I gave you on Tuesday evening of last week when we talked about, when we did Drosophila mechanics, the genetics, and the idea of ever doing a saturation mutagenesis screen or ever identifying all genes. We hoped when we did the screen that we did it at a sufficiently large scale that we would identify all transcriptionally active genes. These are the ones we identified. We kept identifying more and more alleles in these genes and no new gap genes, so we quit on the assumption that those are the only genes that would do this. It is interesting, as Denise said, that they appear to be sufficient. They're the only ones that in the 30 years that have followed, no one has identified anymore.
So do the cells have to constantly drawing the positional information from the environment, or does the information from the previous, from bicoids, get, you know, passed on during development, meaning, or is the information from
passed on in development? Our belief is that the embryo develops inside an eggshell, which is impermeable. Oh, you can spin the egg around, do all kinds of things, orient it in different ways. The pattern is set up by these maternal systems and registered and maintained, transferred, if you will, from one state, the maternal gradient state, to the next gap gene state, to the next, to the parallel gene state. Okay.
Is it okay if I keep asking diffusive questions, or do you
sure.
Really, okay. So there you could have every single cell specified by this thing, but do the cells really do that? I mean, are they really specified? Because later on, if I remember JP's early work correctly, say you establish a parasegment boundary between embryoed and wingless expressing cells, but then at the segment boundary, that's a little sloppy still, right?
Yeah.
The cells are kind of still...
And so what we're not really doing, this... It's actually an interesting problem, because I'm going to end up arguing that, yes, we have this information available to us, but we do know that it's certainly by this stage, but also at the gap gene stage and at a slightly later stage than what we're looking at here, the gap genes begin to cross-regulate each other because they themselves are transcription factors. So we're trying at 15 minutes to get to the immediate response. And interestingly, already in the immediate response, we have the information we need. So you don't need the interactions between gap genes or parallel genes to produce fine scale pattern. The fine scale distinctions are already there. Maybe you need them to maintain fine scale pattern,
But if cells can still move around and...
Yeah, and they could... Yeah, so if cells... At this stage, cells do not move around.
But they later are, on, I mean, when they're established...
Right. And so, and then there are... Yes, and so then you come to the end of the stage and you kind of know who you are, but it is advantageous to you, even if you know who you are, to be open to the world and to change your perspectives on life. And so you cells do that too, and it is probably not good in development to lock a cell in, keeping it, you know, with any ability to communicate with other cells. So what we're doing is we're setting the cells up. And the interesting thing is, for me, is that when you do this, you have the capacity of doing it in unique, reproducible states. You go, and so the information's there. It's not as though you generate specificity over time. The better way of thinking about it might be that you maintain initial specificities through these interactions and through these other processes.
So watching the MS, you know, these more dynamic constructs, the MS2 construct, that really, I never appreciated how dynamic these things were. All these different layers in the segmentation network do appear to come on in NT12, 13, 14. So if my question is, when do you think this sort of positional information is at its finest, is at its most...
This step is 15 minutes.
Into NT14?
Yes.
Just before morphogenesis, I see.
Okay, so, one more.
Sorry. If you compare the fuzziness here to the fuzziness you had for Krupal, the fuzziness here, like this kind of...
We are struggling with that fuzziness because we don't understand it.
Okay.
And we don't know. And so there's certain areas here where a fuzziness comes up in our map and we don't really know. And that might be an interesting question, because fuzziness, it obviously is a certain degree of non-determinacy, of not enough information.
But I guess if you compare this to the previous, where you are only Krupal, if you look at the width, so here you have something which is pretty good when you have like the four gadgets all over the embryo, but if you look at locally, is one gadget enough to give you the same precision?
Approximately, yes. I don't want to go there. Yes. Let's say yes. It's close to. We'll go out on a limb and say yes. And but we can talk about it in more detail, because there's more that I want to know. Okay. So one of the ways, though, of asking whether cells use this is to say, well, let's, if this is the capacity of cells that they have, well, let's mess around with the input information in the egg and make all different kinds of mutant embryos and ask, well, we've changed the distribution of Bicoid, we've changed the distribution of other maternal determinants, and ask if all of these conditions, this lookup table has the same predictive value. So if this is what cells are doing, then they better well, when they see a concentration of Krupal and Hunchback and Knips and Giant, produce the same. So what we started doing is messing around with inputs. I mean, we're talking only about Bicoid, and you realize that, or many of you know from the literature, that the genetic screens that have been done have essentially identified three sources of positional information in the embryo that are supplied maternally. There's a localized RNA that encodes Bicoid, and is at the anterior end of the egg. That functions directly as a transcription factor, encodes a transcription factor, and the gradient of Bicoid encodes a concentration gradient of a activating transcription factor directly. There is a second localized RNA at the posterior end of the embryo, one called nanos, that also produces a gradient at the posterior end of the embryo. That gradient is itself not of a transcription factor, but of a translational regulator that regulates the translation of a uniform RNA called Hunchback, maternal Hunchback. It produces a gradient of the inhibitory and produces a gradient of this paternal. And then there is a receptor tyrosine kinase signaling system that comes from the eggshells at the two poles and activates the receptor that governs MAP kinase activity that ultimately governs the nuclear localization of a third repressive transcription factor called Capiquil. So all three of these are active in wild-type embryos and contribute to the patterning and contribute to the expression pattern of gap genes. So we're going to come back to the specific role of decoid in a second. But what this set of genes allow us to do is to generate conditions where the pattern and gap gene distributions are altered. For example, if you eliminate the decoid, this is where the embryo looks. You actually end up with two tails, weird patterns that aren't fully explainable. But then when we look at the gap gene expression pattern, we get an extremely altered pattern of gap genes. We can go to the lookup table and predict where would be, what is the distribution of identities here. This would be the one on a line, this would be wild type. And what we see is a corresponding pattern of in bicoid embryos of even skip that correspond to the specific positions that we see here. Other gap genes as well follow this pattern. And the pattern is predictable based on the gap gene expression pattern. So bicoid embryos are using the same, cells in a bicoid embryo are using the same lookup table as similarly, for torso, where we eliminate terminal elements, what you get a pattern that's something like this. We get ambiguities, you know, way out of the pit, but these are the positions of the six even skipped stripes in the embryo. We've lost a stripe and spread out the pattern, so that the pattern of the gap genes precisely corresponds to the subsequent pattern in the embryo, again suggesting that in these embryos we're also using the information. We've done this for all possible single mutant, double mutant combinations. If you eliminate all information, you have a single flat stripe that corresponds to a single position in the embryo. Okay, so we have a lookup table we believe works. But we don't really know the information content. We don't really know what it's being based on. We know that gap genes, that it's based on gap gene expression, but what's really controlling gap gene expression? I just told you that in addition to bicoid, there are a number of other systems that will impact on the gap gene expression. So one of the things, most of our understanding of these pathways come from experiments where we genetic experiment where you knock out a component and what's missing and you try to figure out what happened. What I started to do in my own little personal projects, and I kind of partially why I'm involved in this, is to take a different approach, which is to try to ask what can any patterning system do fully on its own. So if we eliminate all patterning systems in the embryo, all four, the anterior and the one, then you get an embryo which is now homogeneous, where pattern is and identities are homogeneous. And that is an interesting embryo to watch because they have no information at all, and they continue on and develop in a uniform kind of way. But then we can take those embryos and add back individual components and ask how much information is present in bicoid. That turns out to be different than the information content potentially that you would imagine is there from looking at mutants. In a certain sense, we're asking how much can bicoid do on its own versus in the wild type, what pattern is possible in the absence of bicoid. Those are different because there are significant redundancies in the control of different gene activities. So there are pattern elements which are clearly influenced by two or three different systems. So what we want to do is just ask, what can bicoid do on its own? Remember, the gradient is mostly measurable for us in the anterior half of the embryo. So what I, these are complicated experiments because to eliminate all gradients, maternal gradients, you have to eliminate some things which are, when you eliminate them, are lethal, like hunchback. So you have to produce do these experiments in mosaics, germline mosaics. Some of the genes, like particularly the torso signaling system, is not germline dependent, so you have to do these germline clones in individuals which are uniformly in all their tissues, torso, and to do that, there were genetic. This is my proudest experiment of the past 2 years, to manufacture the chromosomes, because it involved making OVOD chromosomes that carry torso-like. It was a horrendous thing to do, but I've done it. This is the only kind of experiment that I can really do in the lab, the ones that have kind of long goals, between other jobs. Okay. And so, what is interesting here, and it's easiest to see potentially down here, but it's validated by the expression patterns that they get, that Bicoid on its own is unable to do certain very anterior aspects of pattern. And it goes all the way out to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Actually, I think there's abdominal segments, and then can't do much more. So it's missing these very posterior structures and the very most anterior structures.
And all this stuff by, either in the gap genes or now when you make this particular mutation, is the larva is definitely smaller.
Yeah.
It hatched out as an egg that was the same size. And what happened to all that extra material?
Good question. Cell death to a certain extent. Organs regulate their size, and in the embryo, part of that has to do with if you make a segment primordium which is too big, you do see cell death 4 or 5 hours later. There are sensing systems within each primordium that control their size. Whether they're the same kind that work as that you alluded to in your lecture last week, don't know. But there is clearly a loss, but this segment is in fact, this distance here is actually a bit bigger than here. So there is an interesting thing that could be done here, is to ask, what's the maximum size of coherent pattern? What's the maximum number of cells we can cram into the coherent pattern? To my knowledge, nobody's really done that. Okay. And if you look at the information contents of these, it's pretty good here, and then kind of trails off in these two regions. It is wider, and so one idea that begins to emerge from this that we're able to help is that what this redundancy, in part the precision of the system, depends on having these multiple systems which are contributing information. I don't have numbers for that.
Yeah. How different is that from just a torso exam?
Just not very different. Yeah, let's see. So, okay. What one could ask, though, and interesting is that what we're doing is eliminating maternal inputs here. We know that Bicoid activates hunchback. And one possibility is that these patterns that arise don't directly reflect Bicoid, but are indirect consequences. You turn on hunchback, and then that turns on the next gene. And so what we've begun to do is to, in this background, eliminate specific components, zygotic components. And so if you eliminate hunchback, for example, you still get the pattern, and you still get the gap genes back here. And you get an attenuated pattern. This, in terms of what zygotic, this is just basically what zygotic hunchback is doing. But this argues that the pattern isn't developed by a kind of a relay induction of one zygotic gene inducing the next gene and the next gene. But the pattern, in some way, really does directly reflect output. And so this is posterior happening. This area here, up to here, was all that area where we you know, derived from the back end of the embryo where we couldn't really measure the Bicoid gradient. And then addressing your question is that even though we're not able to really measure or deal with it, the embryo is able to deal with those concentration differences. Yeah.
Sorry, maybe you've said it and I missed it, but what happens to the gap genes if you compare to when you have only Bicoid, what happens to the zygotic back gap genes if you compare the profiles in your mutant versus the wild type? Like the gap genes are the same or are they
the gap genes, so this yeah. is KNIRPS and
so the different colors are the gap genes on the
let's see, I switched from here to here.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to show Eve. So this is actually Eve. This is the gap gene expression patterns. What we don't have is the green.
Okay, so green is the hunchback.
Hunchback. So we're losing hunchback. White is cripple. Blue is KNIRPS. And red is
But so for instance, science. For the middle column, you don't have the posterior hunchback, correct?
The middle?
Like the only because you don't have posterior hunchback.
Right? You don't need zygotic hunchback, you don't have posterior hunchback.
No, but the second one.
Ah, this one here.
You don't have,
right. I would say we don't have posterior hunchback.
Okay, and so you lose EVE7, for instance, because of this. Okay.
Okay. So that's the end of part one.
Trini. Could you look at the appendix?
Sure.
Did you also measure the scaling of those? Patterns, like whether they still adjust to the embryo size.
Say that again.
So the patterns that you have now in the Bicoid only and the other one?
This one?
Yep. Did you also check like whether they adjust to embryo size?
Not really, not yet. Okay, so now we're going to transform ourselves from people who look at fixed embryos and try to measure and think about them to molecular biologists. We want to know how the distribution of a single transcription factor established different transcriptional responses in different genes. How is transcription controlled during the early cleavage division of the embryo? This is where we're going to start doing some molecular biology. Very, very briefly, we're looking at an embryo here, which is going through the early cleavage divisions. We're looking at this one. And you can see the nuclei are constantly dividing at a 10-minute cycle until they reach cycle 13, and then they go through one more round of division, and they pause, and this is cycle 13. So we've measured gene activity right here. One more time. The critical thing that you need to know in terms of the cell cycle is that these early cycles, which are so short, basically involve DNA synthesis followed by mitosis, followed by DNA synthesis. And what happens at cycle 13, essentially, at cycle 13, is the introduction of a G2. So a post-replicative phase of DNA sit and enter into mitosis after about an additional 10 minutes. This G2 is dependent on the DNA replication checkpoints and has traditionally been thought to reflect some problem that arises in cycle 13, where we elongated this, let's shift over, cycle 13, where we have a problem with completing DNA replication. Something happens. Initially, people thought that, well, maybe as you replicate more and more DNA, you have less and less substrate, so you become limited in your DNA replication capacity. No one's been able to find that. What we do know, and I'm going to show you data for that, is that with this activation of the checkpoint here, and this production of a G2 is actually the response of the embryo to activating transcription. The embryo activates transcription, and the presence of these large RNA polymerase II complexes all over the gene, sitting poised at promoters, is what causes a crisis in replication and it induces this we've published. I won't go through the argument for that, but we could. Now, so what we really want, that's the description, what we really want to understand is the molecular biology of this process, is what's actually happening to chromosomes in DNA during these rapid cleavage divisions that allow, that suddenly elicits this poisoning of transcription at cycle 13. And this initiated, in Shelby Blythe's mind, a broader question, a desire to characterize what are the states, what is the states of chromatin, what is the states, what are the transcriptional states, and how do we move through these early cycles. Now, oops. So, what Shelby's done, I think this is really remarkable experiment, but it takes advantage of this wonderful central feature of fly development that you've seen, which is that you have a set of rapid cleavage divisions, and you can visually, and those nuclear replications are synchronous. So your cells are uniforms, and in mitosis, in interphase, and mitosis, interphase, and mitosis. All the embryos, because they're synchronous, all the nuclei in a given embryo are at the same cell cycle stage. So what you can do, and what Shelby's done, is to sit at a microscope and visually select embryos at these stages and allow them to go for 3 minutes or 6 minutes or 9 minutes, or reselect. So selecting mitosis in one cell cycle and then measuring, then processing them for chromatin analysis. Now, the second step here is that because he had single embryos, he had to develop a protocol that allows characterizing, identify a protocol that would allow characterizing chromatin accessibility and nuclear cell position in single synchronized nuclei. And the strategy that he uses is one called the PAC-seq. All that you have to know about that is that it is a reagent that involves a TM5 transposase that is will insert into exposed DNA, and when it inserts, it actually has been engineered to insert not only itself but a primer that then you can use after this process to harvest the DNA. You can identify and amplify the regions where DNA, where this was open and accessible. And you get two kinds of information. Most of it is what we call open, meaning that you have a large stretch of DNA with no nucleosomes. Sit in anywhere, so you get lots of little short, and this is an extremely efficient process, an extremely frequent process, such that you get variable size short fragments, shorter than the 200 or so nucleotides that usually wrap around a nucleosome. Then what you get is, in addition to this open region the small fragments that define and can be, from their sequence, can be mapped back to the genome and define all the regions that are open and exposed. You also get information about specific size classes, which are the size class here is the size class that allows you to map individual position of the nucleosome. So this is a very, very powerful technique for characterizing all aspects of chromatin. So, and basically what he's done is collected 3 replicates from all of these time points, replicate embryos, collected the embryos, collected the chromatin, and sent it for sequencing. And the picture that emerges is we start at cycle 11. You can group genes into 2 classes, but you see it when you map then the sequences to recover by amplifying sites between them. And you can plot them out as open chromatin regions. You can see that already at cycle 11, there are patterns of accessibility that are already established. And then there are also, during the course of development, during the course of these cells, new patterns of accessibility that arise. So we can take these the sequences, for this is an entire, and ask where, you know, what is the nature, what can you learn something about how the process of transcription is governed? And in the Drosophila genome, in his hands, identifying on the autosomes 9,824 peaks, and about 344 are already present in cyclophores. And an additional 6,000 gain accessibility in cycle 12 or cycle 13. So there's a pattern reproducible gaining of accessibility. You can ask, what's the nature of these sites? The early sites are almost all enhancers. So cycle 11, what this suggests to us is that DNA has an inherent structure we don't understand that sets up and makes enhancers available, even in the absence of stable transcription. The dynamic changes are almost exclusively in promoters and insulators, which are regions which define larger structures. Genome activity. Picture so that you have a picture that you start already with enhancers available. And I told you that Bicoid, which is going to be approaching, is going to bind to enhancer, is there in constant concentration in nuclei from cycle 10 onward. So we imagine that the enhancers are poised and bound, and then what changes is some structure of an immediate transcription start site. So you can look at the accessibility changes, and these changes are associated with the 5' region of the gene, the transcription start sites, and as opposed to, you know, general enrichment across other structures. So the critical event that happens at cycle 12 and at cycle 13 is a change in promoter structure. And if you now compare this to another approach where you take RNA polymerase and do ChIP-seq on small numbers of visually staged embryos, what you see is that between cycle 12 and cycle 13, you see a major change in recruitment of RNA polymerase. So the sequence is, enhancers are open, transcription factors bind, at cycle 12, there's a change in the chromatin structure, transcription start sites, that allows in cycle 13 the binding and recruitment of RNA polymerase, which has two features. It allows transcription of those genes, but also it reduces the pause in DNA replication that governs the cell cycle. Manny?
Eric, you know, these beautiful experiments by Disher where they perturb in single cells and stem cells, and forces on the nucleus lead to transitions in the chromatin state, which lead to differentiation. I wonder what your opinion on morphogenesis, okay, forces, and the sort of internal mechanical structure of a nucleus is. What are your,
So we're assuming, and what drives Shelby's interest is this, the analogy from these to these, between these very early stages of Drosophila development and the state of that allow setting up programs in cells that are undifferentiated and earliest states stem cells. How the transition happens, we haven't actually, this is a powerful technique which one can use at later and later stages as cells become locked into fates. We're looking at cycle 13 here, we're not even looking at cycle 14, or the trans. So how do you lock cells in? To do that, we think we need to develop embryos which are homogeneous in their cell types. Because if you're grinding up a differentiated embryo that has 20 different cell types with lots of different promoters coming on, you get into this problem of analyte. And so here at this stage, everything is uniform in the embryo. So one of the reasons why we're making embryos, manipulating these maternal effect genes, is we want to establish pools of embryos which we can follow this later during development and say, as you become neural, we can make embryos that are entirely neural tissue, entirely skin tissue, entirely gut tissue, and say, as you move into one of these pathways, how do you change the patterns of accessibility? Okay. Oh, this, of course. Yes.
Sorry, just a bit confused. So, the gene of the G2 phase, is it maternally regulated or not?
Okay, I cut all of this, but the gain of the G2 phase is due to blocking mitosis after DNA replication. Do you all see that would be mechanistically true? The way that you block mitosis is by activating a checkpoint that blocks entry into mitosis. That checkpoint, in Drosophila are controlled by a set of genes, the CHEK1, CHEK2, MY41 class of genes that when you mutate them, do not have a G2 in cycle 13. They replicate, they go crashing into mitosis at, you know, after a 10-minute cycle, and they die in the most horrible death that you can imagine in a movie ever seen. Because their chromosomes are not fully replicated, they're going into mitosis, bridges happen, they can't, it's very sad. That happens, you've activated the checkpoint because you have not completed your DNA replication. We believe that you, we can have done, I've watched Shelby work. It's really, these are easy experiments where the boss gets to what we've commented earlier. But the recruitment of RNA polymerase to these transcription start sites occurs simultaneously with the recruitment of DNA replication stress proteins like RPA70 that identify sites of stalled DNA polymerase, if you will. And so we believe, it's one of the reasons why we believe that it is the recruitment of the polymerase that drives the stalling, because it's always at transcription start sites, and that's where the proteins, stress proteins, accumulate. If you can't respond to the accumulation of stress proteins by activating your checkpoint, you crash into mitosis and die. If our model is true, then if you can reduce or slow the activation of transcription or recruitment of polymerases, you will, in principle, not require activating the checkpoint, and you will no longer require the checkpoint. So the strongest proof that Shelby has produced for his model is that if you make mutations in the wild-type embryos, which are mutant for the checkpoint, they all come into cycle, at the end of cycle 13, enter mitosis, and all die terrible deaths. If you reduce the activation of transcription by affecting genes that lower by only 50% the levels of transcriptional activation, these are either GATA-like proteins or ZELDA. The wild-type embryos are normal under these conditions. They can have a low, reduced transcription. But the interesting feature is that the embryos which are mutant for the checkpoint genes do not, they don't have a checkpoint, so they still do mitosis early. They don't have to, but they survive. So what's causing the DNA stress, causing the reduction in DNA replication, is the activation of transcription. Okay.
Eric.
Yes.
Hearing about this terrible phenotype reminds me a little of what happened to the last speaker, who went over time.
Yes, okay, so I'm gonna, right, so what we're gonna do, I'm gonna do something very, very quickly here for about 5 minutes to address this picture that we now have. We have enhancers sitting out there, and we want to attract big O protein and activate genes at a particular in particular cells in particular regions. This is a hard problem. Oh, wait, one more thing. Accessible regions are established once they're stable. You open it up so the picture so once you do something to the chromatin and make something, it's stable. This is like epigenetic memory. I just wanted to point out one thing that we're able to see that no one's really seen before, is that since we are picking embryos at defined stages, we can ask, how is that epigenetic memory, that accessibility? Most people think that you mark regions in some mysterious way for this memory, and then chromosomes condense during mitosis, and then you come back and you reestablish these domains. What we see is that these domains in mitosis, accessible domains, never go away. That they are maintained during mitosis. So you see a picture like this of mitotic chromosomes. What you have to imagine is all of this is the condensed DNA, but looping out in tiny little areas that are physically accessible still are all of these little regions. So you do not need epigenetic memory. You only need memory to remember things that aren't there anymore. You remember Paris when you're not in Paris. So the concept of epigenetic memory, I believe, needs to be reevaluated given the precision of these experiments and the idea that you physically maintain the structures, chromosomes, and accessible regions that you've established associated with the situation. Okay, now, for 5 minutes, I'm willing to do that. I'll do this in 5 minutes and then it'll be good, okay? Okay, so what we really want to know is how BigQuery does this, how BigQuery binds the individual genes. A simple way of thinking about it is if you have a concentration gradient, if you have some genes that come out in the anterior region, in the middle, and the posterior region, the boundary, BigQuery is setting the posterior boundary of it, but the permissible zone of expression. And you can imagine that the ones at the anterior have low affinity for BigQuery, so that they only bind or are activated at high concentrations. Ones out here have high affinities. So what we set out to do is to measure affinities. First step was to identify, by ChIP-seq, the regions of the genome that bind BigQuery. Turns out it's not just the four gap genes. There are 127 regions in the genome that reproducibly bind BigQuery. We think these are enhancers. We don't know what their consequences are. We don't know whether they all drive DNA. But this is actually a good thing, because what we want to ask now is, what does this binding depend on? We know that it's not affected by mutations in any of the other patterning genes. That is, you make embryos that have only BigQuery or no BigQuery, that you get the same 93% of the peaks are all the same. So these are peaks which are BigQuery dependent. And so what we need to do is think, among this 1,200, are they differentially sensitive to BigQuery? Because their chemical affinities to BigQuery are different. To approach that problem, what Colleen Hannon has done is been, it's very difficult if you take a wild-type embryo and grind it up, because you have each cell has a different concentration of BigQuery. And so if you do CHIP, you don't really know what you're looking at. So what Colleen has begun to do is been to develop a set of lines which have uniform BigQuery levels, but are expressed at different levels, and therefore mimic levels that are present in this region of the embryo, or in this region of the embryo, or in this region of the embryo. I'm going to show you data from three different lines. What you can then do is take this 1,000 genes here and bind BigQuery in wild type and ask whether in the high expressing lines, those pieces of DNA still bind BigQuery,
And you can see they all do. They even bind better than the average piece of DNA. They love that they're doing. And we lower the concentration. And she has grouped these 1,000 genes into clusters based on their sensitivity to concentration changes. When you look at the genes that are associated with these enhancers, these regions, genes which are what we call high affinity have posterior boundaries that are far in the posterior end of the embryo, meaning where Bicoid levels are low. Genes that are only bound at the highest concentrations, regions are associated with genes that are identical, that bind, that are expressed in the posterior genes. And not so much is known about these things, but there's a general overall course on them. So we believe for the first time that we have a set of enhancers, and we have 100 enhancers in each group, so we can begin to ask, what are the features of enhancers that govern their concentration dependence? What I can tell you is that if you look at the sequences and you do any type of in vitro analysis, you can put CLIRPS, for example, is expressed in the anterior and the posterior region. There are two enhancers. You can take out that DNA and you can ask, physically, does this enhancer bind with low affinity and this enhancer bind with high? By gel shifts, they all have the same affinity. You can't detect any sequence-based difference in there. And yet these, we know from the in vivo studies, that these pieces of DNA are differentially sensitive to concentration. So if you look at them in greater, you can say, well, maybe it's not just Bicoid sites themselves, but other sites that govern. The state of chromatin, essentially the openness or availability. So if you look at the high affinity ones, they have sites which are associated with enriched for chromatin remodeling proteins, like Zelda. Low affinity sites are Zelda sites, but they are enriched for Bicoid binding sites of all kinds, and their chromatin accessibility depends on Bicoid concentration. So to measure the accessibility in Bicoid mutants, these sites go away, these sites don't. So the general kind of picture that we're getting is that these two, if you're high and low affinity sites, high affinity sites are high because they're open and available for Bicoid binding. Low concentrations of Bicoid are able to bind. High affinity sites are closed and require Bicoid binding to remove nucleosomes, push out, and make these areas active. Now, that's the model that we'll work with, and I will end with this, our current challenge, which is we have four lines, or four groups in 1,000, we can group 1,000 pieces in a, so we can see that there's a general trend in these behaviors. What we don't know is whether these trends that we're looking at just account for four groups, or whether within individual groups you can use chromatin structuring, the structure of enhancers that occurs at the beginning of this, to govern their concentration sensitivities that are even much more subtle than the two big broad groups, or three big broad groups, or that we've identified. So we're struggling with informatic techniques that would allow us to maybe extract from the data that Colleen has produced to rank and test whether we, how much of the sensitivity can we account for by these types of structures. Colleen would like to graduate.
and she would prefer not to make 100 more uniform Bicoid lines of different levels of expression. These are generally not stable, so they have to be built into flip-out lines. So this is not; these are not trivial experiments, and she really does want to graduate. From our standpoint, what we're trying to do is to see, can we extract from the wave enhancers this response to different concentration changes? Can we begin to rank them? We'll try to ask, can we come up with consistent pictures? And is there a way of testing those pictures? So I'll stop there. Thank you. Okay. But I will say one thing. If we take the view that position is determined down to a fine and reproducible scale of single cell white stripes or even single cell positions, those identities, those combinatorial code of transcription factors, must drive properties of cells that account for their subsequent morphogenesis. So the question is to ask, I think, from a more predictive, if we accept this idea that things are very finely grained, then how do we go from what are the properties that can be governed down? And some of those properties, like, I don't know, elasticity or stiffness or junctional adhesion, might be passive properties. Other features of cells, myosin accumulation, might be active in the sense that they drive or put forces. And the morphology, though, that you get is going to be the sum of both the active and the passive. And the active is going to be localized, potentially, in a group of cells. But we don't know the scale of the passive. We don't know if the cell constricts here. Can we account for the morphology of the cell immediately adjacent, or can we account? What's in distributing properties in the embryo, we can begin to think about how long force generation here can have long range effects elsewhere or farther away in the embryo. So what's the relationship between the patterns that we see and the physical properties of cells and the final morphogenesis is what you guys should all be thinking about. Stop there. Thank you.
No mitotic catch-up. We have time for maybe two quick questions, but then we need to take fire breaks and back with the rest of
the just wondering if you could say a little bit about the dynamics and temporal integration, because the early analysis was based on a snapshot. You imagine, you know, protein has a half-life of 1 or 2 hours. The concentration is going to reflect some integration of expression patterns over time, and some of these gap gene boundaries are dynamic, they're getting sharpened. And so how much is that going to change our picture of what's going on?
It might. I don't know. It really, the problem for me is it's clear that there's a dynamic that I haven't spoken, that we have access to, have not fully analyzed here over the, and we're dealing with different time frames. It's the question, I think, is the gap genes themselves that are being expressed. There have not been good measurements, but the poor measurements that have been done suggest that the lifetimes of these proteins are fairly short. So early responses, early transcription responses, we don't know what they mean. Right now, we are really focusing on cycle 15 because that's also when we begin to see spatial consequences on their known downstream targets. It's also when their expression levels are peak, and we know that most of these things, transcription factors, depend in a concentration-dependent way. So one possibility is that it is not integration over time, that the dynamics don't make any difference, only make a difference in terms of achieving a condition at a magically determined moment. What's special about cycle 15, I can't tell you, except that it's, but, you know, so that would be, that's one view, that dynamics are useful to get to these states, but the real deceit, but what is crucial really is what is going on at that state. Alternatively, you can have models where you accumulate information over time, that information being transferred over time. You can imagine that you will never understand the process until you incorporate the dynamics over time. I guess, because I'm an optimistic fool, I believe that the easier alternative is the one that's true, or at least the one that I want to follow.
By just when you showed those metaphase chromosomes and you were saying, well, but there must be little loops on the outside. Actually, the chromosomes pack the same way all the time in different cells. I mean, could you, if you had an antibody to some histone, something or other, I mean, would it actually permeate the chromosome if you just did it on a...
Could you
look at what was on the outside?
So there are reports of proteins which remain associated with metaphase chromosomes during compaction.
But if you just had like an antibody to histones and you added it to such a packed up chromosome, is it packed up tightly enough that the antibody wouldn't permeate and then you could look at the surface?
Yeah, right. So in a way, I think... Yes, it would be useful to do that. My sense of the physical accessibility that we're measuring in the taxi gives us a kind of an information about the physical state of the DNA. It doesn't tell us though what protein are so if you have 30 the different types of fibers that you're compacting, clearly you still have lots of histone there in this condensed chromosome. What we don't really know during metaphase is, actually, we are beginning to know that, because when you look at transcription start sites, they have particular spacings and positioning of nucleosomes, and that, I believe, is also maintained during mitosis. So even though you have a loop of accessibility, doesn't mean that you are totally naked. You have positioned nucleosomes, and my memory is that that is maintained also during mitosis.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.